So last time we started considering the quantum electrodynamics process by which an electron and a positron annihilates but creates a muon and antimuon pair. And the Lagrangian that gives you this process in QED is this Lagrangian. So you have two Dirac Lagrangians, one for the electrons and one for the muons. And each of them have the covariant derivatives in them. And therefore, they couple to the photon through the covariant derivative. And I'm adding a photon kinetic term. So there is no direct coupling between the muon and the electron, the muon antimuon and the electron antielectron. So the diagram that we have to consider is this diagram. This is the leading order diagram. There are no other diagrams of this order. This is unlike the Pava scattering, where it was the scattering of an electron and positron, where there were two diagrams. So I have drawn the muon arrow with a different color. So what is the matrix element for this? So this is good practice for writing down matrix elements. So let's just pick one of these fermion lines first. Doesn't matter which one you pick. And look at the charge arrow and follow the fermion line against the charge arrow. So if you do this, then here we see it's a positron that is incoming. So we associate with positron the V spinner, V, because it's incoming, so it has to be a bar. Otherwise, we won't be able to get a Lorentz invariant object. And then we have a vertex factor, gamma mu, minus IE gamma mu, and then an incoming electron spinner wave function. And then we have a photon that is propagating, and we write the photon in our gauge choice, which is the Lorentz gauge. And then if you want, you can use a different colored chalk to write the contribution of the muon. So you say there's a muon in the final state, so you write that down first. So we have u bar because it's a muon, and it's s prime p prime, and then there's a vertex factor like this, and then an anti-muon that is going out. So we associate the V with an anti-muon, an anti-particle. And this is R prime, and this is K prime. Although I've used a different colored chalk, there was actually no reason for me to do so. The arguments of these spinners will tell you which species of particle that we are dealing with, right? You just have to, if you keep track of that, it'll tell you it, you can just say, okay, this is, say, prime. You can also use that, of course, if you don't have, colored pencil, okay? So this is our matrix element. So in scattering experiments that we do, our initial beams are usually unpolarized. And a lot of our detectors are not sensitive to the spin of the final state. So what we are going to observe in experiments, this is not sensitive to some of this information, such as spin polarizations of the incoming particles and the outgoing particles. So the thing that we have to insert in our formula for scattering cross-section is the is the matrix element squared that has been averaged over the initial spin states and summed over the final spin states. Okay? Is on average, in the initial spin states, there'll be spin up and spin down of with equal numbers. So we take the average. And we, because we don't care whether what kind of spin we are getting, we sum over the final. So what we compute is this thing. They're factor of 1/4 because you know, there are two particles coming in. And we sum over all their spin states. This is what we are calculating. And this is a little bit of a long calculation, but I think it's worth doing. And you know, we actually have a bit of time today. So we get two copies of this, well, this one and its complex conjugate. So we should get 4 powers of E, the charge. And then we get V bar R K gamma mu U S of P. And okay, I'm not going to bother with the yellow color anymore. I'll just put primes on them, OK? Then we have a U bar S prime prime P prime gamma mu VR prime K prime prime. And what we do is that we are taking the complex conjugate of this and then multiplying with it with the same thing. And we have a factor from the photon propagator. So note that we have used the metric tensor in the photon propagator to contract these two guys. And that's why they have the same indices here and here. Now, note that this is a number, by which I mean that all the spinner indices have been summed over. Okay? This is a complex number. Now, for complex numbers, which are made out of, say, some string of matrices, yeah, this is true. So that means that, you know, we can replace the star by dagger. And when we do so, you know, all the matrices here, so they're actually, okay, this is a number as well as this, right? So when we complex conjugate, we can interpret that as a Hermitian conjugate and then reverse the order of things. So let me give you an example. So when we have VR of K gamma mu US of P star, This is the same thing as saying that I have U bar of S of P gamma mu dagger V of R. Okay, so
sorry.
There is no, yeah. Sorry?
Why is it U bar?
Yeah, I'm coming to that. Right. So where I've used the fact that the dagger of the gamma mu matrix is related to gamma mu by this formula, and the fact that gamma mu squares to 1. So we insert, you know, we can always insert gamma mu squared, but gamma 0 squared. So when I take the, okay, is that clear that this leads to this? This is just a line of algebra, so let me do this. So we have V bar gamma mu of U, and we are doing this. So we have U dagger gamma mu of dagger, V bar of dagger. So this is U dagger, gamma 0, gamma 0, gamma mu dagger, and this is, you know, this is a gamma 0 dagger V, but gamma 0 dagger is gamma 0 because it's Hermitian, so we can write this as V, and then this is gamma 0, gamma mu dagger, gamma 0 V, so U bar gamma mu. I just realized there's a typo in my note where I actually have a dagger here. That dagger should not be there. So this is very useful. So using this observation, we can now rewrite our object of interest in this way. We can rearrange the factors which involve electron and positron spinner wave functions in one bunch. So we have Vr, K, gamma mu, US of T. This is a number, this is not a matrix. So we can bring the other factor of that it involves electron positron spinner wave functions. And then we can group together the muon stuff. Just rearranging what I've written before. And then there's a factor of T plus K. So having rearranged this, let's look at the spinner indices of this guy. So have I forgotten? I have forgotten the sum and the 1/4, right? So let's look at the so we have over here the S and R are the spin labels, so we keep that here. So we have VR of K, and this has some spin spinner index A mu gamma mu A B U of S of P of B, U bar of S of P of C, gamma mu, C of D, V of R of K of D. Right? I didn't get the joke. Must be something on Facebook. So this you can now rewrite as V of R of K of D. So what we see here is that we have U, U bar, and V, V bar. And we want to use the, you know, the completeness relationship that we had for V, V bar and U, U bar. So we want to basically bring them together. So V bar is A of K. And then this guy just stays here, AB. And then we now, you know, get this guy and this guy, you know, next to each other. And this had an index B and this had index C. And now what we see is that okay, so we can now, you know, use the, okay, this is V A over here, and this is R here. Okay. Now we can use the relationships that, you know, I told you about where summing over V R of K, V bar of K gives you K slash minus mass of the electron. And if you do the same thing with but with U, then you get a different sign. So using this, we can convert these to those operators. But there's another interesting you can you notice, that if you notice the indices, it's D, A, B, B, C, C, D, D. That means whatever this whole thing that is in there has been traced over. Okay? So we apply this, and we observe that fact to write this as trace of K slash minus ME gamma mu, you know, P slash plus E gamma mu. So the tracing only happens when you sum over the, you know, the spin indices. Well, you get this nice expressions. So because the mass of the muon is so much greater than the mass of the electron, we are going to ignore the mass of the electron. So we are going to set that to zero. So then you can use your the trace identities that we went over in one of the tutorials. And then find that this thing gives you 8e^4 p plus k 4 2 times k dot p prime p dot k prime. There's the factor of the two. Sorry. K dot k prime p dot p prime plus 2 k dot p, the mass of the muon. Okay. So then you can go to the center of mass frame. So we want to plug this into our expression for differential cross section in the center of mass frame for 2 to 2 particles. For 2 particles going to 2 particles. And you can just work out all of these inner products in the center of mass frame. And the details are given in the notes. I won't go through that, because otherwise we won't be able to cover some of the interesting things. I won't be able to say some of the interesting things I wanted to say today. So if you do that, then this becomes, in the center of mass frame, this is the mass of the muon. I drop the index. This is the energy of an individual particle, of the incoming particle. I'll write that down. So essentially, these parameters are your electrons are coming in with some momentum p, and your muons are going out, p and k, and your muons are going out with some momentum p prime and k prime. So these are, say, the 3 momentum. Of course, in the center of mass frame, k, 3 momentum is minus p. And this is the angle. And the 4 momentum p of the electron in the center of mass frame has this form. And that's because we are ignoring the mass of the electron.
To the force overall.
Overall, no. Why do you say that?
I'm just thinking that there is some, I mean, this formula is e to the 4 times the first term plus an unrelated second part.
So oh, I see, right, yes, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
I was interpreting E as energy. Like,
sorry.
Okay, thank you. No, I drop brackets sometimes. Okay, very good. So if you do this and plug this into your formula for differential cross-section, then you can express it in terms of what is called alpha. where E, the center of mass energy, is the total energy of the incoming particles. In this case, it's 2 of E. And alpha, its origin is somewhat historical, is defined to be E squared by 4 pi h bar c, whose value at zero energy is this. So this is called a fine structure constant. Because it's related to the fine structure of spectroscopy. You will see in the next course that coupling constants such as E or alpha, they become dependent on the energy scale in which you probe the theory. So when I say, you know, this is a structure constant, I have to say at what energy this is. And this is defined at zero energy. It turns out that for quantum electrodynamics, as you ramp up the energy, the coupling constant actually, its strength increases. That is not the case for QCD. For QCD, you know, the coupling constant actually the strength of interaction decreases with energy. And actually, at very low energy, QCD is not perturbative, and you can't do a Feynman diagram expansion of QCD at low energy. And in standard model, you will see some effective theories that will enable you to deal with low energy. Yeah?
Are you sure it's not reverse? Because I think alpha at 200 GeV is 1 over 127. So. That's bigger, not smaller. Okay.
Yeah.
And never mind. Sorry.
Okay, good. So, so the total cross section. Where you integrate over all of the solid angle has this expression. Now, in the total cross section, there is an energy dependent part that comes from our matrix element, and there's an energy dependent part which comes from doing the phase space integral. Right? Yeah?
You said the constant is defined at zero energy.
Yeah.
The energy of what?
Of the scattering particles. So, when you define the the coupling strength of interaction is defined by some scattering experiment between, say, two electrons. And you have to specify what energy you are specifying it at. And then once you have done the measurement, that tells you what the coupling strength is of that energy. That is how you define the coupling strength. And then there will be these equations called the renormalization group equations, which will tell you how that coupling strength changes as you change your energy. And even if you have not defined your coupling at zero energy, you can use that equation to run it down to zero energy. And that'll tell you, this is how alpha is defined at zero energy. So in the high energy limit, so if the energy of your incoming particles are much, much greater than the mass of the muon, then your total cross-section becomes this thing. And if you had done a naive dimensional analysis, then you would have said that, well, that diagram had two vertices, and therefore it better be proportional to alpha squared. But this thing has dimension of area. And because we are in a very high energy regime, there's only one other, dimensionful parameter that I can specify, which is the energy, of the center of mass frame, which we can take to be. So for this to have the right dimension, it must have this form. So the 4 pi 3, calculation gives you that correction of 4 pi 3. So what is interesting is that you can ask, okay, that's all good, but we know that in this calculation, if you go through the details, there's a dependence on energy coming from the matrix element, right? From this guy. But there is another dependence which comes from the fact that we have to do, from the phase space measure. So if, for example, the matrix element was something constant, then the phase space would still give you some result. So here, my x-axis is the center of mass energy, and my y-axis is some cross-section, times the center of mass energy. And here, this is the center of mass energy, of course, has to be more than the twice the mass of the muon for this cross section to actually be non-zero, because that is the threshold energy for producing muons. So this is what we get if I just do a phase space calculation. But now if you take in the effect of the muon matrix element, so you're actually looking at the dynamics that is particular to your theory, so the QED, this actually gives you a different result. And this is the high energy limit. So this experiment, the measurement of this process in the laboratory is important evidence for QED. So if you had some other theory, you would probably have some different curve than this. So, right? So So the phase-based calculation just gives you a benchmark against which to sort of, you know, compare different theories. So it's instructive to compare the matrix element that we just, you know, computed to another matrix element, to the matrix element of another process in the same theory. So let me consider the case in which an electron and a positron scatters off of each other. So I just noticed I have a typo in my notes. It says electron and positron going to an anti-electron and anti, an electron and a muon going to an anti-electron and anti-muon, it should be, the signs should be, you know, I put a plus sign in the notes, that shouldn't be the case. Okay? Sorry about that. That's what happens when you write up your lecture notes at 9 in the evening. Okay. So this is our muon coming in with some momentum p2, some spin s2. Some P2 prime, R2 prime. Maybe should we have a spin level D2 prime as well? Sorry, that was a Star Wars joke. You guys didn't laugh. So P1, S1, P1 prime, R1 prime, and this is momentum, say P2 minus P2 prime. So we can now readily write down the matrix element for this guy. We have, so again, this is good practice. Let's put a mu here, a nu here. Let's put a mu here. You know, let's take this guy first, go against the arrow. We have an outgoing electron. So it's a particle, so we have u bar. And we have r1 prime, p1 prime, minus ie gamma mu. And then over here, we have an incoming electron. So we write as s1. P1. And then we have a photon propagator, and we can just write that down here. It's I eta mu nu. And let's call the denominator T, because this is essentially the square of this is what we called T. The Mandelstam variable, STU. And then we have the muon part, R2 prime P2 minus IE. Remember the prime means that these are muon spinners. Gamma nu and then U of S2 prime of P2. Okay? And then we can do the same thing as before. We can square it. We can average the over the initial spins and then sum of the final ones. And I actually have done this in detail in the notes. And we Let me call this matrix element 2, because at some point we are going to compare with that other matrix element. So this becomes when you actually done the calculation, 8e4 by t squared p1 prime dot p2 prime p1 dot p2 plus p1 prime p2 p1 dot p2 prime minus the mass of the muon p1 dot p1 prime. Okay. So now note that if we take the first process, which let me just draw that again. And we analytically continue, say, what the incoming electron and the and So if I take, you know, the incoming positron, which is this line, and the anti-muon, which is this thing, so in the outgoing anti-muon, and change them by an outgoing electron and an incoming muon, then we get from this diagram to this diagram. So what I mean is this. If I take this, you know, the amp, and then I say, okay, I'm going to take this guy and analytically continue it to an outgoing state. So it'll look like this. And then this guy is still going out, the muon. But the anti-muon is now an incoming state. Because, you know, there is no sense, time sense associated with the Feynman propagator in between, we can then we see that this is the same thing as this. So it turns out that this is just not some accident, but that the matrix element for this guy can actually be analytically, can be derived from the matrix element of this thing by doing an analytic continuation. And by which I mean that this uses a property of Feynman diagrams called crossing symmetry. And I think Dan proved it, or at least explained it in the case of scalar fields. And what crossing symmetry tells you is that if you have a matrix element with some process in which you have some initial particle in some initial incoming state, that if you analytically, if you consider the same initial state except the first incoming particle, same outgoing state, but with the antiparticle with reverse momentum, four momentum, you know, negative, then the two matrix elements must be equal. Yeah?
Four momentum negative or spatial momentum negative?
Four momentum negative. So this is a formal mathematical, you know, properties of amplitudes. And it is never true that if this is physically allowed, that this is also physically allowed. But we can do this twice. And then we can have cases where it is physically allowed. And using that trick, we can actually derive the amplitude for some processes from some other processes. And we'll now see that that is the case for the two, you know, for the two expressions that I've derived. Now, the expressions I've derived are summed over the final spin state and averaged over the initial spin states. Whereas this statement is true without that summing and averaging. However, it's much harder to show that with all the spinner, you know, indices hanging around. So I won't show that for the general, for the unsummed case, but for the summed case, we can show this. So how do we do this? So if we now go back to our case over there, let me bring that down. And I will need the amplitude for this, so. So I will need that expression. Okay. And if we now take our anti-electron from the initial state, from the initial, and put it in the final state, so we are take our anti-positron with momentum p2, and we take it to an electron with momentum minus of p2, and we take the anti-muon with momentum p2 prime to our muon as a final state with momentum minus p2 prime, then that expression becomes 8 e to the power 4, p1 minus p2 squared, and then p2 dot p1 prime, p1 dot p2 prime, p2 dot p2 prime, p1 dot p1 prime minus m squared mu p2 p1. But this label of the of these guys are not the same labeling as this. So we need to do a bit of relabeling so that, you know, this analytically continued amplitude has the same amplitude square, has the same labeling as those guys. And this is done by, if you do a bit, do it carefully, So if you label now P2 to be P1 prime, and P1 prime here to go to P2 prime, and P2 prime go to P2, and P1 remains the same. Then using momentum conservation, you need to use momentum conservation? No, you don't. So P2 prime, P2 becomes P1 prime, yeah. Right. So if you do this, this relabeling then this is, you can see that this is the same thing as that guy, right? Okay. So this is quite nice and satisfying. However, you cannot get the cross section of one process from another process, because this symmetry of the amplitude, which is really a symmetry of Feynman rules, is not respected, does not hold for the phase space, measure. So this correspondence, this symmetry only holds at the level of your matrix elements. Okay, so we have to start by 10 today. So I'm just gonna ask you to be a bit patient and not take the break. But we're gonna finish early, so it'll have a longer break, right? So our last topic for today is polarization sums. So we have learned the technique of summing over and averaging over the spin states of fermions, but we also need to do similar things for photons, because our experiment might have some initial state where we have a photon going in, and we may not have a polarized beam. Or the final state might have the same, and our detector might not be sensitive to that. So we have to learn how to do the analogous thing for photons, and that's the last topic today. But it'll lead us to something interesting. Well, actually, that's not the last topic. I'm going to say a few words about gauge invariance after that. So, consider a process which has an external photon polarization state, say epsilon mu lambda, where lambda is the label of the polarization. So there is some amplitude which we call M of lambda. So M of lambda will have the form of some amplitude times the polarization, right? It'll have this form, where this will be independent of the polarization. So summing and averaging over the polarization tells me that I have to sum over the external physical polarization. So we have to consider this object, which is, if we now decompose this thing, So what is important to note is that there are, the sum is over the physical polarization, which are the polarization states of the external photons. But for matrix elements, which you know, contain photon states, also secretly contain the current, because the photon creation and annihilation operators, you know, they couple to the current through this, you know, through this interaction Lagrangian. Well, there might be a minus E here. So which means that, you know, these amplitudes actually have this form, that they are the momentum space version where the final and the initial state are the states of your, of the diagram that you're considering, except the photon that is under consideration. But you know, current conservation tells us that, you know, this must be true, because we can take the derivative operator inside. But this implies, when we rephrase it in terms of what's happening to mu, that if you take the momentum of the external photon, and contract it with m, where m is defined in this way, that gives you zero. And this is an example of what is known as a word identity, of word identities. And they are statements of gauge invariants of correlation functions, at the level of correlation functions. I will come back to this point in a short while and motivate it further. But for now, let's pick an external momentum state of a photon that is traveling, it's a plane wave photon traveling in the z direction. So let's take a very specific example and see how we can use these observations to do the polarization sums. So so let's take this guy. To be our photon for momentum. Then what the word identity tells us for this particular photon momentum is that the zeroth component of our matrix element is equal to our third component of the matrix element. Right? And that's because our eta 0, 0 is plus, eta 3, 2 is minus. Right? That's what this is. K mu mu nu eta mu nu, and that gives us mu 0 k eta 0 0 plus k mu 3 eta 3 3, And this is minus 1, this is plus 1. And for this to be 0, means that this is, this has to be equal to this. So this means that if we now go back to our polarization sum, which was sum over the physical polarization, so there is just M1 and M2, which is entering in this expression. But we can add to this. So we can add to this, you know, M0 squared and, sorry, minus M0 squared and M3 squared. And write this as a sum over all four components. Am I doing it right? We have 1, 1, we have 2, 2, and then we. Oh, I think, yeah. Sorry, I think we have to specify for this the epsilon 3 and epsilon 0, right? So we have to say that epsilon 0 in this case is this guy, and epsilon 3 is this guy, right? And then, you know, we can write this. So what I'm saying that, you know, the 0 and the 3, you know, the 0 and the 3 term, although we have formally written it here, doesn't actually contribute to this sum. Okay. And then there is, here, this is also very important. Yeah. Because otherwise, you know, this, you know, the 0, okay. The 0 component and the 3 component cancels out because there's a sign flip coming from here.
Maybe a minus sign somewhere there, because we're using the mostly negative metric.
Sorry?
We're using the mostly negative metric signature, aren't we? 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1.
Yes, you're, but why would there be? Because if it's, if you take the E00 component, this is.
No, I'm looking at lambda equal 1 component now.
1 and 2 have to have the same set.
When lambda equals 1, e to lambda lambda minus 1.
Right.
Which means that it should
I see, right. Lambda. Okay, so you're saying there should be a minus sign here?
Yep. Yeah, I think so.
So when we have eta, because we have a, yeah, okay, good, yeah. Okay, now we can use the completeness relationship. Yeah?
Why is the sum being changed?
Oh, the sum is being changed because, so we are adding to this, we are adding to this the zero component, So the zero component and the three component in this sum cancel each other out because of this relationship and this relationship. Okay, so we can always add something that is zero, right? So I mean, that's just a mathematical observation that we can do that. Physically, why that is so is the following. Remember the completeness relationship I wrote down for the polarization vectors for photons? That involved four polarization vectors. What was the completeness relationship? It said that if you summed lambda from 0 to 3, and did this, take the polarization, the vectors, and sum them up in this way, then this will give you the Minkowski metric. So this property involved a sum over all four linearly independent polarization vectors. We want to use this expression to simplify our sum all over the polarization states. So that's why I add something that is zero formally. It is zero, but which, you know, recasts this expression in a form where I can now use this.
Is it really true that we have only one lambda that shows up four times? I mean, it would probably be the same if we do lambda, lambda prime, right? Because it's somehow not really standard notation, I guess.
Then you'd have to, like, sum over lambda.
Because eta is diagonal anyway, so that enforces that.
Sorry?
Eta is diagonal anyway, right? So we could
Then you'd have to have another sum.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I've never seen this notation with four indices being the same.
Right,
so,
it's just because, you know, because we started with a sum over there. With an explicit sum, that's why I'm writing it like this. You know, when we first wrote it down, we probably did this. We did lambda mu of star, and then a lambda prime of mu, and then eta lambda lambda prime. We did this, right? Where the sums of over repeated indices were implied. But we are taking here the case where the coordinate system where eta is diagonal and constant. In fact, all of quantum field theory on flat space-time is done in the Cartesian coordinate system. Yeah?
What happens if you don't?
I've thought about it a lot, and the Lorentz invariance becomes very, you know, it becomes very involved to implement this algebraically. You know, Lorentz transformations, the boosts, you know, they kind of, you know, prefer Cartesian, you know, coordinates. I think it's important that you know how to reformulate at least the formal expressions in a non-Cartesian coordinate system, because that's exactly what you would have to use when you are doing quantum field theory on curved space-time. I've read people talk that say things like somehow the Cartesian coordinate system is preferred, somehow it's picked out by quantum field theory, and also there is this whole procedure of weak rotation, which you know, you were talking about a couple of days ago, which allows a formal analogy between quantum field theory on flat space-time and statistical mechanical system at zero temperature. And that weak rotation, you know, is something where which it becomes nicer if you're in some Cartesian coordinate system. At least, you know, although you're just doing the time there, but you know, it's much nicer in that case. But I think at the end of the day, it has to be coordinate. It has. You know, you should be able to use whatever coordinate system you do. Okay, so using this now, we can write this as M star mu M of nu eta mu nu, which is M star mu M mu. In other words, when you do a polarization sum, what you can do is that you have some polarization sum, and you have this guy, mu, and its conjugate, mu. Then under the sum, you can replace this sum by the Minkowski metric. That is basically what I've shown. So this is the rule. This is basically the prescription for doing polarization sum. We didn't have this problem in the spinner case, because in the spinner case, all the spin degrees of freedom were physical. And therefore, when we did the sum, you know, we had, you know, we summed over all the physical degrees of freedom, and therefore we could use the completeness relationships and, you know, simplify the expression and written down traces. But for photons, the external physical degrees of freedom do not span the whole polarization space possible. And therefore, they don't, you know, satisfy the completeness condition. So for us to be able to simplify that, we had to invoke gauge invariance, Ward identities, yada, 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 and then, you know, show that, yes, you can, under the sum, do the same. Okay, just a few more words about the gauge invariance, the Ward identity. You might say, how is this in any way related to gauge invariance? To do this, let's take a plane wave. So I'm being very imprecise here, because A is actually supposed to be real, but I'm writing it as a plane wave with an exponential, an I. Now, if I do a gauge transformation, say, which keeps me in the Lorentz gauge, where now, say, chi is, you know, it's a solution to this equation, because that keeps me in the Lorentz gauge. And chi has some form like this. And you can add the complex conjugate to these equations. Then what it means is that under a gauge transformation, what you were calling your polarization changes, but changes by some, you know, factor that we don't care about, times k mu, where k is the momentum of the light-like momentum. So where k mu squares to zero. So if our matrix element, this thing, is to remain gauge invariant, it must be true that for light-like photons, for the external photon state, this thing has to be true. Otherwise, you know, because under this transformation, it picks up a term of this form. So that's why this is a statement of gauge invariance. You might say that this is all very formal and has no computational, you know, relevance, and that's actually not true, as the next example shows. So I will leave the details as an exercise. It is not hard. And then, so let's take the Compton scattering. And I'll write down the matrix element for this, because we actually have never written down a matrix element which has a photon in the external state. And this will be practice for that. So Compton scattering, which is very famous for the particular nature of light, or particle nature of light. You have a photon coming in and absorbed by an electron going in. And the photon is absorbed, is re-emitted. So this is a scattering of electron and photon. Let's call this mu and then. However, this is one diagram, but there's another diagram where the photon is emitted before it, the final photon is emitted before the initial photon is absorbed. So what are the amplitudes? So what is a matrix element? Okay, let's take the first diagram and pick our fermion line and go against the fermion line. So we see an electron coming out. So it must be an U, and it must be bar, because that's otherwise it won't be Lorentz invariant. And we have P prime, S prime. And then we have some vertex at which a photon is going out. So we write E of star nu q prime. But we also have a vertex factor for qd. So we contract these guys. And then we have a propagator. From here to here, we see a propagator, a fermion propagator. And I see that some of my P's and Q's have been eaten up by the app that I wrote here. Never mind. So we have a propagator, which is I. P slash plus Q slash, that's the incoming momentum, plus the mass of the electron divided by P plus Q squared minus M squared. And then we have another, so from here we come here, we have another vertex. So we write down another vertex factor, call this mu. And we have an incoming photon, so we write down the photon polarization for that incoming photon. And then we have U of P for the incoming electron. So this is that, diagram number one. And diagram number two is similarly U bar S. I'm just going to write it down. So now suppose I do a gauge transformation. Then each of these terms, the epsilons will change by a term that is proportional to their momentum. So these terms will pick up new terms. And it turns out those terms don't vanish. Like the term that this guy picks up is not equal to zero. The term that this guy picks up is not equal to zero. However, their sums vanish. So how do you do this? The way to do this is to take one of those, you know, polarization tensors and replace it by its momentum, because that is the term that you're going to pick up. And you can show that if you do that in two of these, you know, if you just change this guy and this guy, and using the, you know, momentum, energy momentum conservation relationship, the two new terms that you get cancel each other out. Okay. So this means that, you know, gauge invariance is preserved at each level of your perturbative expansion, at each order in your perturbative expansion, only if you sum over all the Feynman diagrams. That if you consider one Feynman diagram of a particular process, that object does not preserve gauge invariance. Which is, I think, is a very beautiful, you know, property of Feynman diagrams. And I want to finish there. Thank you for your attention. You can ask me questions.
So this word identity that K mu mu vanishes, does it allow for some geometric interpretation of mu? I mean, that is somehow, I don't know, some null hypersurface or something.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about that. It's very, very interesting. But yeah. Because mu, you're saying is mu doesn't vanish, and we know that if we can have two null vectors which do not vanish, whose inner product is zero, right? It may be true. I have not thought about it. That's a very, very interesting question. I think you'd have to go deeper into probably the meaning of word identities to see that. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting question. I don't know what it means. Yeah?
This last one with the gauge invariance. Is this like a useful, not entirely way to complicated way to find relative minor scientific literature?
The gauge invariance? No. I don't think so. So for example, here there is no minus sign, right? There is no relative minus sign in this diagram. This is not a useful way of finding minus sign. However, crossing symmetry, if you're doing everything correctly, and if there are two diagrams in your physical process, so at a which are related to each other by crossing symmetry. I have to think whether that's actually allowed, but suppose it is allowed, then you should be able to get that minus sign without, you know, without thinking about it. But then I think doing the Feynman diagram is easier. but there might be something there. Because I think in some of these diagrams that we did in the tutorial, we saw that, you know, if you flipped the one of the final state with the initial one of the initial state, you actually get to the other diagram, right? So those two things, those two diagrams are related by crossing symmetry. So if you wrote down the first the Feynman diagram for the amplitude, part of the amplitude for the first diagram, and you use crossing symmetry very carefully, and you had all the, then the stuff that you would get should include that minus sign. Anything else? Yeah?
So I was thinking a case that, like here we have crossing symmetry, we have the word identity. And in general, word identity comes from like what kind of.
Right, all gate symmetries will give rise to word identities.
Can we generate it from like some other
symmetries? Like the global symmetries, you know, word identities are statements of gauge invariants.
Only gauge invariants. But is it possible that we use order symmetry to just fix our n without doing any?
Yeah, of course. But you won't have covariance, but yes, you can.
So in that case, like, can we do the, like summing over all possible Feynman diagrams?
Yeah, you'll still have Feynman diagrams, yes.
What I mean is that we sum over all the possible levels of Feynman diagrams, just using this, all kind of, like, symmetry.
So you're saying somehow to use the word identities to somehow magically sum over all the Feynman diagrams at a given perturbative level?
Sort of. Like, in a very, very, very ideal case, then our word identities will sort of just restrict our enemy to be just on a, let's say, two-dimensional plane, and then we can use, I don't know, like, some other symmetries to make it to sum over all possible.
Okay, so let me get this. You're gauge fixing your theory in such a way that you don't have any residual, that all your polarization states, well, you always have some residual gauge invariance. And so there will always be some version of this word identities, right? And I'm not sure how word identities are powerful, so I'm not sure exactly what you want to do. Sorry, I'm not really getting it.
Actually, originally I thought that the word identity can also generate from other symmetries other than gauge symmetries. So in that case, you can have, like, use all the symmetries, you can get a set of, like, something similar to word identity. And then using this symmetry, you can just fix the amplitude without doing anything.
Right. Okay, so I see. So you're basically saying that can I use symmetries to generate amplitudes?
Yes.
And I think the answer is yes, but you can only do that for very special quantum field theories which have huge amount of symmetry. So, and I think those are the kind of quantum field theories in lower dimensions, you know, which have, say, infinite dimensional conformal invariants and stuff like that. Or, you know, theories with sufficient amount of supersymmetry and things like that. There, you know, those exosymmetries will constrain your amplitude in ways that you can actually get a lot of information without using symmetry properties. So in that case, yes, probably there is a version of what you're saying. But exactly how that's related to gauge invariance, I'm not sure. But I think, you know, people like Freddie, they're doing something kind of similar. You know, a lot of these people who are trying to write down, you know, exact amplitudes for n equal to 2 supersymmetric theories and things like that. You know, so yeah, my answer is I don't know. But, you know, but if there is enough infinite, a lot of symmetry, then it seems that a lot of these amplitudes are highly constrained. And that may be related to what you have in mind.
example of your theory, you can use bootstrap to use our symmetry.
Right. So, but bootstrap is something different, right? I mean, bootstrap is a different idea, right?
Yeah, but it uses the conformal symmetry and the unitarity to fix all the.
Right. So, I mean, it's not. Yeah, I mean, it is related to conformal symmetry and therefore, you know, to some kind of word identities, but yeah.
By usually, we can do the Feynman diagrams in a gauge invariant way. So if we use color decomposition, we can decompose some amplitudes to some gauge invariant amplitudes.
So you said, what's the question again?
No, that's just a comment.
What's a comment?
So I said that using, so Feynman diagram is gauge dependent, right? But we can use color decomposition to write it in a gauge invariant way, partial amplitudes.
Right. Okay, any other questions or comments? But even if you have, you know, yes, Jean, right, Jean?
I'm just wondering how you transform epsilon mu.
I added to a mu something like this, chi, and when I take the derivative, this brings down a factor of k from here. And what it is telling me is that, you know, that means that the new epsilon, which is, so then I rewrite, so this is my new a prime. And this new A prime has some new epsilon prime, but that epsilon prime now contains the old epsilon prime plus a factor of K mu coming from this guy acting on this. So, and G is some, you know, factor that I don't care about. But the point is that, you know, under gauge invariance, your this object, the matrix element, you know, picks up a term of this form, and this better be zero if this is to be gauge invariant. Okay, so I mean, let me just end the class, and then you can ask more questions. I'm around so that people who want to take a break can take a break.